Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. I'm still in St. Helena, little volcanic outcrop in the middle of the South Atlantic, one of the most isolated communities of human beings on planet Earth. So lots of History Hit content being produced here. Just you wait. It's going to be awesome. It's not just Napoleon Bonaparte, all sorts of other stuff as well. Did you know that on this island, there is the most important archaeological record of the Middle Passage of the transatlantic slave trade anywhere in the world? Yep. Watch this space. Lots coming out here soon. This podcast, however, has nothing whatsoever to do with St. Helena. It has everything to do with Roman Britain or un-Roman Britain. Just how far did Roman ideas, language, culture, religion, politics, demographics penetrate into Britain during the Roman occupation of Britannia from the 1st to the 5th centuries AD? In this podcast, I talked to Miles Russell, who doesn't think it did penetrate very far, and he's got lots of fantastic archaeological evidence to support the idea that Roman rule was just a bit of a veneer, or certainly confined to isolated spots around our island. You can check out lots of Roman history on historyhit.tv. It's my new digital history channel. You can go over there, you can use the code POD6, P-O-D-6. You can watch my documentary on St. Helena. You can watch various documentaries on there. You can check it all out. But if you go over there, History Hit TV, use the code POD6, P-O-D-6, you get 6 weeks for free. Make up your mind. If you like it, then go on and become a subscriber. It'd be great to have you on there. Lots coming up in 2020. In the meantime, everyone, here's Miles Russell. Enjoy. Miles, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
That's quite all right.
I'm so interested by this, by your work, because I often wonder whether we should think, we think about ancient empires in the way that we think about the sort of, the 20th century empires, big blocks of pink on a map, and that it looks contiguous, but it's almost like we're talking about a Roman Empire made up of nodes of Romanitas with a sort of hinterland that actually is almost untroubled by Roman rule.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's very easy to think that the Roman Empire is one sort of homogenous, uniform block, and it's the same type of civilization right the way across the empire. And it's not sort of local ethnic identities remain intact. But as you go further to the peripheries, and certainly Britain right on the margins of empire, you've got large areas where the old Iron Age British tribal identities survive. And we can see that in burials, you can see that in religion, you can see that in housing styles. And it's really, I guess, Rome's very good at defeating people militarily. But the question is, as you get out into the fringes, is it great at winning the hearts and minds of the population to want to make them become Roman?
But in a way, like, does Rome care about that? You know, it's like until nationalism gets invented and mass mobilisation of whole societies, it's presumably, if you're a Roman leader, as long as, you know, the Alpine valleys are sort of quiet, you don't really care about what goes out there. And the same is true of Britain, you know, on the borders of Wales, and local tribal rulers or elders kind of hold sway. As long as they don't kick off and they pay you a bit of tribute, does it really matter?
I think that's exactly right in the sense that, I mean, Britain's one of the most heavily garrisoned of territories within the Roman Empire. And certainly around Hadrian's Wall and the northern part of Britain, you've got a dense concentration of soldiers there. But Britain is making money. It's contributing to the finances of empire, especially with regard to agricultural production. You've got the lead and tin mines in Western Britain. You've got the gold mines and copper mines in Wales. So it's generating a lot of what the empire, you know, the Roman Empire is a resource hungry state, and it needs these sort of raw materials. And Britain has got that. And I think as long as Rome is able to utilize that and to make money, then ultimately, as long as things are peaceful, they don't really mind. I mean, in one or two instances, this causes a problem, because obviously in AD 60, you've got Queen Boudica of the Acheni rising up against Rome. Essentially, her tribe had been given money just to keep quiet, but they don't seem to have been won over to the Roman cause. So at several points, there are difficulties that Rome experiences in Britain, but by and large, it tries to delegate authority to the British tribes, because it doesn't really want to heavily garrison the southern part of Britain where you know, you've got lots of agricultural production. But as long as it's making money, as long as it isn't an overall drain on resources, then I think they are relatively happy to let the Britons do what they've always done and not to interfere too much.
And is that why we get the sort of idea of a colony, meaning not what it's come to mean in early modern British history, world history, which is a sort of a big geographical region, if you like, a colony like, you know, the Virginia, but a colony like a town like Colchester, Camulodunum there are little nodes, are there, of where the Romans do sort of build little versions of Rome.
Yes. I mean, Colchester is a very good example, because Colchester is one of the first towns to be established in Britain. And as a colony, essentially, it is for retired soldiers. It serves one of two purposes. It's a way of getting rid of soldiers who've done their 25 years service, because Rome obviously has got the first professional army in the ancient world. So after their 25 years service, they can be retired into this new town and be given land and property and so on. So it gets rid of that issue. But also Colchester could serve as a model town, sort of like a Milton Keynes in the Roman Britain. You know, it's showing you this is how a town should work. This is the benefits of a civilized way of life. Now, Colchester doesn't succeed too well, because you've got the problem that the Britons aren't that enamored by the place. You know, you've got people who up until fairly recently were killing or enslaving them or lording over them, and now living in the town and doing pretty much the same sort of thing. So during the Boudican uprising of AD 60, Colchester becomes the main target of hatred and is burnt down. But the idea persists. And after Rome has quelled that rebellion, it creates towns. It basically creates the infrastructure of towns. So, you know, you've got the roads, you've got a forum, the economic centre, you've got a basilica, the administrative heart. And then you can build up bathhouses and amphitheatres and key elements of a Roman way of life. But to be honest, once Rome has established these towns, these tribal centres across Britain, it then moves away. And it's a case of relying on the local elite to convey a sense of Romanness, to oversee Roman laws and to keep things running. But I think, as we said earlier, as long as their tax is being paid and money is being made, then Rome really isn't that too bothered. And when you look at some of these towns implanted into Britain after the first sort of 60, 70, 80 years, they're not hugely successful. You can see that animals are being corralled inside the towns. There are pottery kilns, there are metalworking. They look a little bit more, I suppose, like you'd expect a shanty town, a Wild West town in the US, you know, in the 19th century. They don't look like Mediterranean style towns. And I think the problem is we've tended to look at these urban centres in Britain and equate them with Pompeii and Herculaneum and all these other great Roman cities and think they were exactly the same. And once you get below the skin, once you get into the archaeology, you'll see actually they're not like that at all. They're set up to be great functioning urban centres, but the reality is on the ground they weren't. And I think that's really a fault of the Roman state not winning over the hearts and minds, but also the Britons being a little bit cooler towards the idea of wanting to be Roman.
How interesting. And what does population density look like in southern Britain in this period? Are people, nowadays we think of, you know, most of us live in towns and cities. Would it have been far more even, of course, far fewer people, but spread across, you know, in subsistence agriculture? I mean, would it, and therefore these towns wouldn't have been as important in the economy as Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, London are now?
Yeah, again, today I think we get so focused on towns, and certainly in the Roman mindset, the town was the centre of civilization. But when you look at the population spread, as far as we can understand it, in the late Iron Age, at the time that Rome arrives in the first century AD, you've got a very scattered and diverse population. You've got one or two key centres in the south and east. You've got relatively dense population centres at key places like Chichester in Sussex and Colchester in Essex, where trade is being enacted between Britain and the Mediterranean world. But once you move away from that, you've got small farmsteads, you've got clan groups, you've got probably two or three families in a little clusters of roundhouses farming their landscape. It's quite a politically fractured landscape. And in one hand, it makes it relatively easy to conquer because, you know, when the Roman armies arrive, you've got thousands of these sort of heavily armed, well-trained soldiers, but they've got no one really to come up against because you haven't got the political organisation there to bring large field armies to fight against Rome. The Britons are very good at guerrilla warfare and attacking the Roman army while it's on the march, but they're absolutely hopeless when it comes to pitched battles. So it's very easy to defeat them, but then it's very difficult to try and bring them into this Mediterranean idea of towns, because whereas when Rome conquered in Egypt and across the Aegean in Greece, there you've got civilizations that are similar to Rome. They understand the importance of towns. They've got well-organized, structured society. In Britain, it's very dispersed, tribalized society. And I don't think they're ever fully won over to this idea of what a town should be. And they don't fill it with the same kind of functions and resources that we'd see a Roman town, say, in North Africa or in Greece.
And so the archaeology, this is fascinating, because we assume, don't we, that, sorry, stupid people like me assume that there were all these sort of Brits that just eventually started living in towns and going to the baths and things. So these towns were not a success. We should think of them as the sort of model towns that perhaps the Soviets would build in strange parts of the Soviet Union that were just never properly kind of, you know, moved into as the builders had intended.
I think, yes, yeah. I mean, you can compare them with that. I think the trouble is we get blinded by the sort of the archaeological skeleton of these places. You know, you see the road layout, which was set out by the Roman government in the earliest stages. And what happens with a lot of towns, say, like, for example, Dorchester or Cirencester, is you see in the last few decades of the Roman Empire in the 4th century AD, suddenly there's a big explosion of townhouses. You get massive mosaics and big elite structures being built. Now, that's because I think a lot of wealthy people are moving into the town. They're moving into an undeveloped part of the Roman Empire. So these might be wealthy business successes from other parts of the Roman world moving into Britain, but they are developing their own private estates within these towns. So the towns are becoming more sort of like almost like a sort of an elite ghetto. You know, this is where you've got a closed estate where the wealthy are building their luxury apartments, but they're excluding the rest of society. So we see this archaeologically. I mean, you dig in Cirencester or Dorchester and you see mosaics and it's very easy to think, well, this is fantastic. The Britons are all living like Romans, but they're not. It's just a very small minority of extremely wealthy people who at the very end of Roman Britain are moving into the not very successful towns and developing it for their own ends. So it's a bit like when we focus on that side, the wealthy side, and we look at the villas, it's a bit like trying to understand, say, 18th or 19th century England by just looking at stately homes and not looking at the rest of society to get a better picture. I mean, the Roman archaeology is fantastic. It does look amazing and it is, you know, incredible to see, but it only represents sort of less than 1% of the population within the province at that time.
So when we look at, say, the West Country, so Exeter and its hinterland, and then up to Chester and its hinterland in the northwest, you think there would have been a sort of pinprick of Romanitas, and then would the people outside the walls of those towns or outside those towns, would they be living almost on truck? Would they be living beyond the Roman state? Would they be taxed? Would they be doing military service? What would their relationship with Rome be like?
It's certainly very difficult. They would certainly be taxed. They would be contributing to the Roman program. But it's interesting, the further you get from the towns, the less Roman it becomes. You see, like, a lot of the excavations that we're doing now in Dorset, you can see as you move away from the key Roman towns, you suddenly start discovering longhouses and roundhouses. The sort of structures that are being built in the pre-Roman Iron Age are still continuing 100, 200, 300 years after the invasion. And there are a few sort of Roman coins on this site. We get some Roman pottery, but it's almost as if people are carrying on the same sort of existence. And they're not really buying into a Roman market. They've got the odd sort of knickknacks. They've got these things that are helping facilitate or better their lifestyle, but they're not becoming Roman. They're not restructuring their houses in a more Mediterranean way. They're not going over completely to this new style of fashion. Now, whether that's either deliberate resistance to these ideas or whether it's more passive in that they don't see any benefit about being Roman, they don't see any sort of financial incentive to become Roman, but they're just carrying on their own sort of lifestyle. So often when we see forts up on Hadrian's Wall in the militarized zone, or we see towns like Chester or Exeter, they're like little sort of bubbles of Roman lifestyle. And once you start moving 10, 20 miles away from these, you're moving into a more rural landscape within which native culture patterns survive. And it's only really towards the end of Roman Britain that we get the villas being almost injected or built or developing into this landscape. But as I said, you know, that seems to be more to do with a wealthy elite, possibly from another part of the empire, rather than the Britons themselves. You know, when we look at villas, it is very tempting to say, this must be the native Britons who've wholeheartedly embraced Roman culture. But it doesn't look as if that's the case. You know, they're developing 300 years after the invasion. So the success of a Roman lifestyle in distant Britain is actually very limited.
Have you ever wondered if the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were actually real? Or what made Alexander so great? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, where I'm joined by leading academics, best-selling authors, and world-class archaeologists to shine a light on some of ancient history's most fascinating questions, like who built Stonehenge and why? What are the Dead Sea Scrolls and why are they so valuable? And were the Spartan warriors really as formidable as the history books say? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, you say whether it's passive or whether it's sort of actively anti-Roman. I mean, Britain was one of the most heavily garrisoned provinces of the Roman Empire. That's partly because of the strategic threat from the north of the island, and I guess the Irish. Is it those external threats, or is there a sense in which Boudicca in 60 AD and then one or two other risings, they were this was a troublesome province to police?
It was always a troublesome province, yes. And towards the end of the empire in the 3rd and 4th centuries, it becomes extremely rebellious and turns its military strength against Rome as people are trying to break away from the empire. But I think the difficulty really with Britain is that Rome wanted the metal reserves that it got from Wales and from Devon and Cornwall. It wanted the agricultural production and the taxation from southern and eastern Britain. It didn't really have much to gain from northern England and up into Scotland, because there you've got very sort of pastoral landscapes, not that much intensive agriculture going on, a very dispersed settlement pattern. And it's very difficult to garrison that. I mean, Rome, certainly in the first century when Britain was invaded, didn't really conceive the idea of frontiers. It was always about, almost with missionary zeal, spreading their word, spreading their culture across Europe. And occasionally they came up across natural boundaries like the Sahara Desert, or political ones when they come up against the Persians in the east. But in Britain, there's only a small part of the island that really they were that bothered with, that they thought they could exploit financially and politically. And so if you're ignoring northern Britain, you need a substantial garrison there just to keep them away from your investments in the south. So you're right, there's about three legions throughout the history of Britain, which is about a tenth of the whole military garrison strength of the empire is invested in Britain to keep that northern frontier secure, and then later to protect the harbours on the western part of Britain against sort of tribes from Ireland who weren't conquered, and then later from the first sort of English pirates coming over the Angles and Saxons during the great sort of migrations. But it's a very tricky province to really control, and towards the end it becomes too expensive. And it becomes so politically troublesome because there are basically, if you're in charge of a significant military garrison in Britain, you're feeling cut off and separated and divorced from the rest of the empire. I think it's very tempting to build up your own empire because you can protect yourself. You can protect your harbours. You can create your own sort of state away from Rome. Rome seems too distant. If your taxes are going off in that general direction. In the third and fourth centuries, it seems better for a lot of politicians in Britain to break away from the rest of the empire and do their own thing. So I think the danger there for Rome is there's just so many soldiers stuck in Britain. And if they haven't got anything particularly to do, then they become a source of rebellion.
So it's all getting a bit Brexity now. It's all getting a bit contemporary here.
Well, I mean, I think that's the danger. I mean, it might be something to do with the sort of the political sort of ideology in Britain, the sense of an island nation. Their leaders sometimes feel, why are we interested with people overseas unless you're controlling your own empire? And yeah, unfortunately, there are certain parallels you can see with the way in which British leaders tried to break with Rome in the same way that they have been doing recently. And of course, then you've got decades of civil war and economic collapse afterwards. But that's another story.
Hey ho, yeah.
Hopefully, it's not going to be repeated.
Right. So because I'm reading Peter Heather's book on the fall of Rome, and he says actually Britain was almost at grounds. Britain's the ultimate example of where Romanness was almost completely extinguished. In terms of language and religion and architecture and everything else. So it sounds to me like that's not a product of these violent, barbarian Anglo-Saxons, Jutes and everything coming across. It's actually just because it never really took hold in the first place. So it was always, Romanness was always fragile in Britain.
Exactly. I think it's that very fragileness that is the issue, because when you look at 5th, 6th century Britain, you don't get any aspects of Roman culture really surviving. Arguably, in little pockets of Christianity surviving and Latin being the language of the church. But beyond that, with regards to Roman religion, Roman settlement types, the Roman language, Roman legal system, it all goes. And I think the issue there is that the Britons have effectively rejected. I mean, the only people who are wholeheartedly embracing Roman culture in the 4th and 5th centuries are the wealthy elite. And once the economy breaks down, they're either dead or they've changed allegiances or they've gone somewhere else. The bulk of the British society has never really been brought on board the Roman sort of programme. And so by the time the first Saxons settle in Britain, there is no Roman culture surviving. So it's not a case of these Germanic peoples coming into Britain and in the very sort of Arthurian tradition, a mythical figure defending Roman culture against these barbarians. The Saxons arrive, Roman culture's already dead in Britain. It's been dead for decades. So neither the Britons nor the Saxons are sort of inheriting or continuing a Roman tradition. It's only much, much later in the 6th and 7th centuries when you've got the Catholic Church bringing Christianity back into Britain, do you see a revival of Roman ideas, and you see the first sort of Saxon monarchs and kingdoms, and they start using Roman text on their coins. But that is Roman ideas and Roman culture being brought back. When they arrived, it was completely dead.
That's absolutely fascinating. And what sites are you working on at the moment that are really shining a light on this?
Well, as I say, we've been digging a whole series for the last sort of 10 years or so. We've been looking at Bournemouth University. We've been doing a number of excavations around Dorset because you've got here the Durotriges tribe, which were settled before the Romans arrive. And what we've been trying to do is trying to understand what happens when the Roman state, when the Roman army has moved through. Because the idea, you know, it's always been felt that you've got a town like Dorchester being developed. Surely the natives were shaved and washed and put into togas, almost like a sort of a Roman reservation, and they became Romanized. And of course, that's not the picture at all. So we're taking a whole series of native British sites in and around the Dorchester area and investigating them and seeing what happens in the first, second, third, fourth centuries. How do they develop? And we're finding more and more that native burial patterns continue uninterrupted. Native building styles continue. And yes, you do find coins and pottery, but society is never being won over by the Roman cause. So blinded though we are by big masonry structures and mosaics, it's the native sites, timber buildings, which of course don't survive prominently today, but there's many more of those. And it's really that story that we're tracing and trying to give a more nuanced picture of what's happening in Britain as part of the Roman Empire. Because as I said, it's not a great success for Rome. Yes, it makes money out of this territory, but it never really wins the people over. And it's trying to understand why and how that happens and looking at the archaeological evidence to try and elucidate that.
We can't answer this, but why do you think, is it just time? Is it just... It's just you just need generations to make that process happen. Why do we think the people of southern Gaul became more Romanized if they did?
Well, I guess the difficulty when we look at someone like Gaul is that Gaul and modern day France, it's conquered extremely quickly. You've got Julius Caesar marching his soldiers into there, and in a series, you know, over a decade, we are seeing in the 50s BC of a population base probably about 3 million living in central France. A million are killed. Men, women and children are slaughtered by the soldiers they come in. A million are probably enslaved, and you've got a third of the population left, and the whole political system is in tatters. And at a very basic level, from that point onwards, it's relatively easy to impose Roman control and build towns. And over time, you know, generations later, when the population base has increased, Gaul becomes an extremely successful and Romanized part of the empire. In fact, it embraces Roman culture arguably more successfully than any other Western provinces. Now, in Britain, you've never got that kind of population cull. You haven't got that kind of disruption or dislocation. Rome is very keen to sort of, I mean, on the one hand, it's never meeting massed armies to fight against, but it's very keen to delegate authority. It's the cheaper option. It's more, arguably, from their point of view, cost effective. But because population isn't disrupted significantly, I think it retains its culture patterns and identity right the way through the Roman conquest. I mean, you could argue after, you know, World War II, Eastern Germany becomes probably one of the most prominent and successful communist states. But it's gone through significant disruption. Population, has been scattered. And so the new systems embed themselves quite successfully and quickly. I think the same thing's true in Gaul and France, that there's so much disruption, there's so much slaughter on an industrial scale that afterwards the survivors, there's no resistance to Rome whatsoever. Whoever's left embraces it. And generations down the line, it's extremely successful. So I think on a very basic level, Rome needed to kill more people in Britain to embed Roman culture more successfully. And thankfully, they didn't do that. But because of that, you've got native patterns surviving for far, far longer than they do in France.
Well, that's an amazing, amazing thought. I did not know about those Gallic figures. That's absolutely astonishing.
It's quite shocking, really. I mean, Julius Caesar's often put up as one of the greatest Romans, but when you look at it in those sort of terms, it's the kind of extermination, the kind of social dislocation that he enacted upon Gaul is just shocking.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Miles Russell. How can people find out about what you're doing and keep up with you?
Well, as I said, the Bournemouth University website, we've got lots of reports on our excavations going on. If you look at Durotriges Dig on Twitter, you'll find out our reports. And Unroman Britain, where myself and Stuart Laycock looking at the unroman nature of the province, is published now with History Press.
Brilliant. Unrome Britain, everyone. Go and check it out. Thank you That's very right. much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
He tells us what is possible, not just in the pages of history books, but in our own lives as well.
I have faith in you.
Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying, and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it, and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good, and then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't want to buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.